streams were the main creators of the mountain landscape. You know, that's that whole idea, fluvial dissected plateau versus mountains, that, you know, fluvial dissection just as a fancy way of saying streams cutting or incising into the landscape. That's been going on for tens of millions of years. So when you're looking up at the mountains and you're down in the, you know, the modern streams, say you're like in the Westkill just below the falls, and you look up at the mountains, you're looking at this landscape that streams have been working on for, you know, tens of millions of years. It's amazing. And the really cool thing is, if you're, especially say you're on the Westkill and you're at the falls, you're at that, the Diamond Notch or Buttermilk Falls, whichever name you want for it.
Yeah.
And you look at that sandstone, and that sandstone that you see, that, you know, the water is flowing through those beautiful little flumes and then over.
The bushwhacks were some of the worst days I've ever had in the mountains, or life, really.
Whereas Panson Mountain is totally opposite. It's a mountain on top of a crater.
I think the weather challenges on this incident were particularly difficult.
It was really the development of New York State. Catskills were responsible.
Now you're listening to Inside the Line, the Catskills.
All right, so gearing up for this this crazy 100th episode weekend at Camp Catskill. So I'm nervous and excited at the same time. We're having the 100th episode celebration at Camp Catskill. It actually be the 100th episode, which is I didn't think would happen, because I would use the Sounds Like a Search and Rescue podcast, their episode, but I decided not to. I decided this would be a genuine 100th episode, so it's going to be nice. But tonight is episode 99, right before the 100th episode. I have Danny Davis, and we're going to talk about geomorphology and the Catskills, which is a huge discussion with nowadays, with certain times that we have going on, with the rapid flow of water, with the water supply going down to the New York City area. It's a huge topic that I love, because I'm into geology, and I'm more into the geomorphology, you know, slide stuff like that. So Danny is here with me tonight, and we're going to talk about that stuff. So welcome to the show, Danny.
Yeah, thank you. Enjoy. Listen,
I'm excited to have you here. I'm excited to talk about this. I can't wait to talk about it. So the one thing I wanted to start this off with is a big reality check from my friend Darren White. He supports the show, stuff like that. He went up Becker Hollow this weekend, and he already knows hiking in general, but a lot of people don't know the shortest route isn't always the easiest route. Becker Hollow kind of points that out, and he said he saw a lot of people just going up there in regular shoes. He said a lot of husbands and wives, and the wives weren't really having fun. And taking Becker Hollow, you know, is very short route, you know, shorter than going, you know, from the Spruceton area or even from the Devil's Path. Shows you that the shortest route is not always the easiest.
It's a great training route. You know, like when you want to get a lot of elevation really fast, but I have crossed paths with many families that weren't quite quite connecting the fact that the shortest route is the steepest route. But it's my favorite way to go up and down the mountain.
Yeah, it's for, you know, people like me and you who have done this for a while and stuff like that. It's a fantastic way to go up to train, to get yourself a little bit stronger, a little bit more into the mountain, and get up there quicker to enjoy the view a lot more often, more like a little bit more than usual. But a lot of people, you know, a lot of people underestimate going to even Giant Ledge is one of the things that I'm crazy. It's 1.6 miles, but it's 1.6 miles of brutal climbing.
Yeah, especially in the shoulder season when you could have ice that people aren't expecting.
Yeah. Correct. Yeah. Even so, it's just, you know, it's wet. It's always some crazy, just not even scrambling, but, you know, you're not going straight up like a footpath, like going up, you know, regular fire tower or stuff like that. So it's the big reality check. The shortest route isn't always the easiest. But, you know, you might find some other routes that actually you enjoy more. So might want to take the longer way. It might be better. So a couple rescues that have happened in the past, you know, week or so, I've gotten so many emails about this and so many notifications. About 22-year-old male called for help after saying his feet were too cold to go any further on Mount Carrigan in New Hampshire. Mount Carrigan in New Hampshire. So this happened only like a few days ago. So it was November 13th. So today is the 14th. So yesterday, hiker called 911 atop New Hampshire Mountain saying his feet were too frozen. And then the call dropped and authorities received a call again at 11:30 a.m. Sunday, November 11th from Mount Carrigan, New Hampshire, saying that the 22-year-old was near the summit of the Desolation Trail. And he made a call saying that his friend was a short distance away and that he couldn't move any further because his feet were too cold and he couldn't move. And so rather than hiking the shortest route back to the trailhead over Mount Carrigan, they hiked an 8-mile loop in the opposite direction, which kept him in front of rescuers. So instead of basically staying where they were, they hiked opposite of where the rescuers were coming over. Cause you know, being in search and rescue, you're going to take the shortest route up there, kind of like the quickest route up there that you can get to the person as fast as you can. So with 100%, they want you to stay where you are at all times possible so they can reach to you and they can help you. But these two hikers apparently kind of went the opposite way. And so the rescuers were following them. And then all of a sudden, you know, it was towards the end of the hike and they actually made it to the trailhead, those two, and the rescuers were still behind them. Just very, very crazy stuff to happen. Once again, this is the Northeast. So it's happening. It is that time of year of where the bottom might be a, you know, beautiful day of 50 degrees and sunny, but then you get to the top of the peak, you know, say Hunter Mountain, you know, Slide Mountain, stuff like that. It will be cold, windy, you know, snow, freezing rain, hail, whatever. It's a big difference from the bottom to the top. So crazy. New Hampshire Fishing Game warns people that this is the time of year that you're going to get screwed in the mountains. Short to say. Danny, you've told me you've been in caught in situations like that before, correct?
In tough situations where I've been caught out in the cold.
Yeah.
Yep. I spent quite a bit of time in Alaska where I was out in the cold a lot. Sometimes longer than planned. And even here locally, but never in except for once in Alaska on a glacier. That's a whole story. Have I really, really been in danger? You know, like I've needed to call someone. And often, and if it's deep winter, I will often have a partner with me. So we can usually resolve whatever issue there is. Just have lots of gear.
Yeah. And being in those situations, you know, having those with the partner and your knowledge, it's how to survive in those situations. I guarantee this was an unprepared hiker. I mean, if your feet kind of freeze, you kind of don't know what you're doing out there in the winter, let alone. So
once you get on one of those, it's hard to imagine being in a situation where your feet are too cold to advance. It's something that you would probably catch earlier, you know, get it before it's a problem. But that's just experience, I think. You know, the more you do it, the better you get at knowing what you have to do to get there. So hopefully it doesn't, you know, dissuade them from doing it again, but doing it better.
Right. Exactly. And we all have those moments that we learn. It's basically learning by kind of like, I don't know, like experimentation. You know, I was one of those people that I hiked up. I always say this. I always love admitting this. I hiked up in khakis. I was freaking hiking in khakis. People hiked in jeans. My khakis would get frozen. You know, I live and learn. And I thought it was hilarious looking back at it and seeing, you know, these, like some of these people, some of my old friends like Ralph Reindeck and you know, Alan Villa would hike Marcy in the middle of February with jeans and a flannel on, and they had a six pack in their thing. I'm like, what the hell is this? I'm like, I thought cotton kills. Like, and they were just like, yeah, we rocked it. I'm like, what the hell? It's crazy to see that. Yeah. So crazy stuff once again. Shoulder season is coming. It's here. Pack your spikes, please. Just put them in the backpack. 1.5 to 1.8 pounds. Nothing. It'll save your life. One other last discussion. I got so many emails and then links from this from a lot of people. So it's a really unfortunate event. A Colorado hiker who had been missing since August has found dead with a dog alive by his side. So absolutely insane stuff.
Wow.
Rich Moore was missing since August 19th. And his dog, Finney, was found alive by his side. He's 71 years old, who was hiking a 13,000-foot mountain, was found Monday, October 30th, approximately 3 p.m., after 2,000 hours of searching for him. And amazingly enough, his dog was found right by his side, kind of clinging to him and stuff like that, which is absolutely insane, absolutely heartbreaking. To find that. But you know, it's Jack Russell Terrier, and just those dogs are insane dogs anyway. So
well, they're fiercely loyal too, I think. So
100%, they'll fly right by your side. So it's number one, you think of people like hiking will bring their like big massive, you know, pit bulls or German shepherds or stuff like that. And sometimes you see once in a while some crazy like small dogs or stuff like that. Jack Russell Terrier is a small dog. So hiking in 13,000, 14,000 foot mountains in the Colorado Rockies is absolutely insane. And for him to pass away and for the hiker to survive, or the dog to survive, has got to be absolutely crazy. And to find him after, I don't know how many days, that's over almost 2 months of searching for him. They probably called off the search a little bit later after, you know, 2,000 hours of hiking, of searching. Wow, it's just absolutely insane. What a crazy event to happen. Once again, this was like 15 days or 14 days ago. So unbelievable, crazy stuff. What are your thoughts about that, Danny?
Well, it's the first time hearing it. It's quite the story. I think I'm going to look up more, but I'm amazed that a Jack Russell Terrier survived, you know, 2 months out there and still stuck around. So, you know, it says something about the skills of the Jack Russell Terrier,
right,
to be able to make it. But if I die on a mountain like that and I'm in my 70s or 80s, and I had a dog by my side, that would probably be a preferred way to go. I had my dog, Irie, known as Danger Dog. She was a member of our team, Danger Girl. She did 6 rounds of the Catskill 35 with me and did all but a couple of the Adirondack peaks because they were just too much. Having a dog mountain companion is a great thing.
Wow. That's, and I couldn't agree with you more about dying like on a high mountain, on a mountain in general, with your dog by your side. I would feel 100% sorry for the dog, but you know, that is definitely the way to go. It sounds sad. I'm sorry. I'm laughing at that, but that's my preferred way to go, is my dog by my side. You know, I love my wife, but my dog.
Yeah, well, I'm just not going to think about mine. We'll see what happens.
Right. So once again, crazy times in Colorado. Blackhead Peak, 71-year-old male dies with his dog by his size, and his dog's still alive, you know, almost 2 months later. Absolutely insane. So once again, welcome to episode 99 of Inside the Line, the Catskill Mountains podcast. I have here Danny Davis with me, and we're going to talk about geomorphology in the Catskills. He will explain geomorphology a little bit later. I'm not too acquainted with it, but Danny, how about you just give a real quick couple sentence thing about geomorphology? How about that?
This is like a test. All right, 2 sentences. Geomorphology is the study and science of landscape forms and the processes that make those forms. That's my first sentence. And my second sentence will be, an example is the geomorphology of the Catskills involves how are these mountains formed, what forms them, and, you know, what direction are they going in terms of their changes. So that's geomorphology. It's studying landscapes, basically.
Wicked. I got to admit, I love this because I am always curious of how things are formed. You know, you look at cols, you look at the tops of mountains, you look at different things. Everything has a unique way of being formed, especially in the Catskills, because it's not like it rose up, you know, from volcanic ways or from the tectonic plates or stuff like that. Catskills are very different. So we're going to talk about that tonight. And I have Danny here tonight. So once again, thank you to the monthly supporters, Darren White, Vicky Ferrero, John Kaminsky, Jim C., Michael Bongner, David Mee, Matt Smith, and Denise White. Thank you guys so much for supporting the show. Greatly appreciate it. Also, thank you to my sponsors, Outdoor Chronicles Photography. Molly from Outdoor Chronicles Photography specializes in adventure elopement and adventure couple photography in the Catskills, Adirondacks, and White Mountains. She is also an officiant for getting married and a licensed guide, but she is also a story maker. Molly won't just give you photos. She'll give you memories that will last forever. Don't hesitate to get a hold of Molly on all platforms. Also, Molly might be at the 100 or so talk to her there. She's there. Hopefully she's there. Also, have you ever wanted to learn about more about hiking or backpacking, or even just brush up on some of your old skills in the backcountry? Check out Trail Bomb Project, a hiking and backpacking school located in New Jersey. Scott and Joe from the New Jersey Search and Rescue Team have amazing backgrounds in wilderness first aid, wilderness first responder, and the Mountain Rescue Association, and they are there for you to learn old and new skills of hiking and backpacking. They teach anything from first aid, map and compass, and many other skills that could help you and others while on the trail. Check out them on their website and all social media platforms. They have stuff going on every week, and hopefully we'll see them at the show as well. So, Danny, you having anything to drink tonight, sir?
I am, because I listen to your podcast some. I know that you asked that question, and you like cider, so I got some cider. But the store that I shopped at didn't sell a lot, so it's Brooklyn Cider House Bone Dry. Are you familiar with that?
Not at all. Is it good?
Well, I don't drink a lot of cider, but I like it. It's dry, so it's not super sweet. It's dangerous. This is my second one.
So. That is good. Thank you. So everybody's just like always like, oh, I got to step on the foot. No, I want you to be comfortable and have a good time with this podcast. That's what I want. I want it basically to be like a talk where, and I hate to say this, that sometimes we're at the bar and, you know, we just got done with a hike and we just kind of getting to know each other. So,
all right. So we're at Snyder's Tavern, let's say, and it's kind of crazy.
Crazy.
Got to sort of take in the taxidermy and everything. But all right.
Greatest place ever, where you see some other guy that's 98 years old and like yelling at you because you hike Wittenberg up the trail and he did it bushwhacking.
Yeah, we were just there two nights ago, Saturday. We actually bushwhacked up Wittenberg.
Nice.
And then and it was a Team Danger Girl outing. It was me, Danger Girl, Mountain Joy, GPS, and none of us had been at Snyder's, and we'd always wanted to go, so it worked out perfectly. There was just one other customer and us, table, some drinks, and then we were out of there. But it was nice. It actually was a picture of Ralph Rindack and another guy with a bear.
Of course.
And the bartender was great in telling us some of the stories of the taxidermy that was in there. It was cool.
So I love Snyder's Tavern because, number one, my friend Joe and I kind of go there for information in the Catskills. We always just contact people and be like, hey, let's meet at Snyder's Tavern. You're comfortable there. Or cool. We just go there and start chatting. And once again, Ralph Rindack is right around the corner from there. And he's a goddamn legend, the Catskills. I've always, you know, I want to get him on here. He wants to do it like in person. So I have to drive all the way down to Ashokan. That's like,
it would be worth it. I've been on many wonderful hikes with Ralph, and we have crossed paths, both of us bushwhacking the same mountain on this, you know, not realizing that we're out there. And we actually happened to cross paths, even though we weren't on a trail.
It's unbelievable. Awesome. It should be. We got to put a petition in to rename this to the Rindack Mountains instead of Catskill Mountains.
I don't know.
it just seems like this guy has like scoured every inch and stuff like that of the Catskills.
That's wonderful. It's great that his backyard extends into all those peaks.
Yeah, it's beautiful. But yeah, Schneider's Tavern, awesome. Brooklyn Cider, I can't wait to actually try that. I'm going to try that. I have myself an Awestruck Blackberry right now, a hard cider that is sweet, though. It's sweet. I love the sweet stuff.
Oh. I'll take the dice then.
Once again, I gotta like you said, you're into your second one. I'm into like, I'd have to say my third. I wouldn't say third, but
all right. So we're pretty relaxed. Okay,
100%. So I'm trying different sodas, like more healthier sodas than just regular colas and stuff like that. And I tried something of a pop where it has like only like 2 grams of sugar instead of like 22 grams of sugar. It was different. It was definitely a different taste. But it kind of felt a little bit better. So I tried that with some rum and Coke and rum and soda. It was a mango orange or something like that. It's very good, but it's just, of course, you got to get used to it and stuff like that. You got to get used to a different pop. I guess you would say it as the Canadians would say it, and then up north towards the west would say it, pop. So once again, Awestruck, and then my flavored soda, I guess it would be. It was really good.
All right. So you're set.
I'm trying to get healthier. So you said your previous hike, you went up Wittenberg, bushwhack up Wittenberg. Tell us the story.
Sure. Yeah. So the Burroughs Range are my favorite. When I say the Burroughs Range, you know, I'm just thinking with Cornell and Slide, but there's more. But that's my favorite part of the Catskills that I like to visit. And especially with my Team Danger girlfriend. So we went up from Traver Hollow. We parked at the end of Bradkin Road and then went up to a knob on Samuel's Point, the ridge that trends off of Wittenberg to the southish, eastish, I guess, east. And went up there, went up Samuel's Point, and then over to the base of the steep slope that just goes straight up to the shelter, you know, the little cave shelter below the summit, and then the summit. And then from there, we traversed over to the Van Benschoten Trail and descended the col between Wittenberg and Cornell via that, the Van Benschoten Trail, down to essentially crossing Wittenberg Brook again and then back to Moon Hollow. So we did sort of a through hike from Traver Hollow to Moon Hollow.
Nice.
Finishing in the dark.
Oh, wow. Did you guys start late or?
You know, it's, yeah, I think so. We probably got started around 10. We had intended to get started around 9, but, you know, it involves families and changing plans and figuring out what will plan B. So plan A involved private property, but not having permission. So during hunting season, especially. So we, plan B was this other hike, which was the Samuel's Point Wittenberg hike. It was great. It was my 63rd visit to Wittenberg, I think. Something like that.
Wicked.
It's obsessive. Yeah.
Well, it's nothing wrong with that. Wittenberg is one of the most fantastic peaks, both with the view. Yeah. With the view and the geology, no matter what approach you come from.
Well, that approach, if you take that face, that steep face, is just one cliff band after another. So you just, there are always ramps, right? So you can always find a ramp through them. But some of my friends really like to climb. So they had, you know, there were challenging sections you could climb, and there were ramps for those of us that were looking for the safer, you know, route up. It's great.
That's a fantastic route going up like Samuel's Point and stuff like that. You definitely got a lot of different geology aspects with it going up. Like I remember going up with my friend Jim one time, and there's like an open, kind of like a, it almost feels like a quarry, kind of like up on Samuel's Point, where a bunch of rocks all over the place. And you're like, what was this? And it once again, boost your mind of just like, what the hell was this? Was this a quarry? Was this not a quarry?
Well, I think, you know, so here's the geomorphology part. You know, we're hanging out in the bar having our talk and you tell me that. And the first thing that comes to mind is if it's the same spot I think we're talking about, that's just weathering. So that's geomorphology. That's just thousands and thousands of years, at least 10,000 years of just exposure to the elements that kind of can break that rock apart. But also in some places, there's just no soil that forms. So you don't get the vegetation. You see those nice big bare sections. You see that on the Lane Street Trail too, you know, that big open section as you approach Wittenberg all along that. So that whole ridge has kind of a really cool weathered, weathered terrain like that.
Yeah. I can understand why you are obsessed with Wittenberg, because any which way possible is an awesome, fantastic
experience. Yeah, Woodland Valley too. Up from Woodland Valley is great. So how about you? What was your last foray into the Catskills?
Oh man, I haven't been in the Catskills in a while. I haven't hiked in a while, because last Sunday I had off, I went into Camp Catskill and kind of tested everything. Mm-hmm. This Sunday I had what we call a Friendsgiving with my neighbor down the street. We just had a good old friends time out, had a Thanksgiving with our friends, and I just haven't hiked. I gotta get out there. I really do. I'm starting to get kind of depressed.
Yeah, I mean, it helps me. I mean, it's my therapy, really. So
yeah,
I just make sure I get out and do it. I was in Alaska in September and October and got really sick after I had done probably the best mountain climb hike I'd done in years. It was pretty amazing. And then the next day I got sick, and I was sick for at least a month, and I'm just now getting back into the mountains for like the last 2 or 3 weeks, and it makes all the difference.
Yeah,
just get back.
So with that hike in Alaska, did you get sick from the exposure?
Maybe exposure to my grandkids, whom I love very much. But it was, except for the lower, maybe 1,000 feet is above tree line. So there is a lot of exposure. I just got sick from, you know, traveling and hanging out and getting a bunch of the bugs that were going around Seward, Alaska, where
you gotta hook me up with anything in Alaska. I just, you know, glaciers are my like passion.
Dude, that's what pulled me into geology, glaciers.
Going up to Banff and up to Jasper National Park and actually going up to the Athabasca Glacier. I like touched it and I almost start like crying, because I was just like, I'm this close to something 17,000 years ago. Like,
yeah, it's pretty amazing. And I keep going back to a lot of the same glaciers over just like, say, the last 10 years, and seeing how much retreat is happening.
Yeah.
So being able to access glaciers and see glaciers and experience glaciers is like a privilege that's, you know, getting harder and harder for some people to experience. Yeah. So where my daughter lives in Seward, Alaska with her family. She works for Kenai Fjords National Park, and it's a terrain that's just defined by glaciers in this very mountainous landscape, because it's where one tectonic plate is subducting underneath another. So you get to the west, you get volcanism, a big chain of volcanoes. That's the Alaskan Peninsula. But the Kenai Peninsula isn't volcanic, but it's being scrunched up. So you have this uplifted terrain, and then just have massive ice fields and glaciers that have carved this terrain. And then over the last, say, 10 to 20,000 years, they've retreated and created these beautiful fjords. But the glaciers were always still pretty accessible. And just like in the last, say, 20 to 30 years, the retreat has just been really dramatic. You know, just the photographic evidence. And then just in the last 10 years that I've been going every year, I've seen a lot of them retreat. It's pretty wild.
Wow.
Scary.
Yeah. Yeah. Seeing the, you know, the stuff online, the pictures online, I'm fascinated with glaciers. So seeing the retreat of some of the stuff that I've been to, like I've been on the Pedo Glacier in Banff, the Athabasca Glacier, just seeing the retreat of that. That you have to hike, like up in Alaska, you know, some places where you have to hike like a mile or two in.
Yeah.
20 years ago, now it would be 2 to 3 miles in nowadays, which is absolutely insane to think that that much is like those. And people think that the glaciers aren't like, they're huge, hundreds of feet tall, you know, Yeah, it can be hundreds of feet tall and then wide, half a mile wide. For that much ice to melt in that short of a time is absolutely insane.
Yeah, yeah. And we see it all in terms of how it's changing the ocean levels.
Yeah.
Well, I hope you get to Alaska. It's really worth it. It's easy to get there, just a flight. And then if you go to the Kenai Peninsula for sure. It's just south of Anchorage. It's easy to get to, and there's everything there, just everything that you can experience.
Awesome. So excellent. Thank you. I will definitely get there. No, it's a bucket list. I know it's a freaking bucket list. So also, right. Once again, this weekend, I'm going to try to release this early. Usually I release this on a Monday, but I would try to get this out as fast as I can. This Sunday, which is the 19th, is the 100th episode celebration and live broadcast at Camp Catskill. So if you can make it, cool, make it, please. We have raffles going on with Westkill Brewing donating, Phoenicia Diner donating, Camp Catskill donating, Catskill Center donating, Scenic Route Guiding has donated. Bunch of people have donated, and this is all going to go to the Catskill Trail Crew. I've hooked that up with the New York New Jersey Trail Conference, and I've hooked that up to make sure that this goes straight to the Catskill Trail Crew. My friend Matt Smith is on there, and I really want this to go straight to them. So we're going to do that. So raffle, big, huge raffle, cool stuff. 100th episode. It's going to be a party, going to have fun. We're going to broadcast live. So if you can make it, please make it. That'd be cool. If not, just tune into the episode. But
and what time? What time are you doing this?
Once again, thank you, Danny. 3 p.m. at Camp Catskill in Tannersville. If you can make it, please make it. That'd be pretty cool. If not, that's cool, whatever. Support the show, whatever way you can. Listen to it. I don't care. If you're listening to it, that's great.
I think Tad and I are going to try and do the Eastern Devil's Path that day. So that's in the neighborhood. So maybe if we get done in time, we see if we can stop by.
Tad, he's not going to make it. You got to slow him down. And okay, so here's a test. Slow Tad down and see, like, oh, I don't know if we can make 3 p.m. and see what his dedication is. Because that guy is a boatload of information for me. He's like my 100, like he gives me all this information.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. A great, great person to hike with. That's the thing about the Catskills. There's no shortage of great people to hike with. It's really it's a wonderful community, really.
That's what, that's what I say. I just feel like these mountains, the community is tighter than other mountains. I don't know why.
Yeah, it's hard to say. I don't know. I mean, I'd say that's probably true. Maybe, I mean, the Adirondacks, there's a lot more people that come from farther away there. So I think there's maybe a little bit less of that, but it still seems like there's a community. I used to stay at T-Max and Topo's. And then there was definitely a community of people that would stay at that place.
Yeah. But test Tad and be like, I don't know. We're going to make it at 3 p.m. I don't know. We might have to miss this.
Well, I'm sure he will take that as a challenge. Tad, if you're listening. There you go. Someone just challenged me.
Yeah. So I'm just going to talk about the volunteering. 3500 Club has trailhead stewards. Sign up for next year. Once again, Catskill Trail Crew just finished their last little episode down in the Huckleberry Point Trail, the Huckleberry Loop Trail. Phenomenal job by the Catskill Trail Crew. Catskill Mountain Club, Visitors Center, anywhere you can volunteer, it makes a massive difference in the Catskill area. Trust me, 1 hour to 8 hours could make a huge difference in your trail, and it can make your experience 100% better. Also, if you're ready, if you want stickers, contact me, contact Camp Catskill down in Tannersville. They have some there as well. So once again, thank you guys. So we'll finish up with some of the sponsors. So is it time for some new gear hiking in the Catskills? Say no more. Camp Catskill in Tannersville has all your hiking needs. Footwear, socks, moisture-wicking shirts, freeze-dried meals, Catskill merchandise, and of course, the most important, micro spikes. They have all the essentials for your hiking needs located in Tannersville and online. check out Camp Catskill if you want free stickers. Also stop here. Also, 100th episode is going to be celebrated here at 3 p.m. Sunday. Also, if you already hit the trails, make sure you take Scenic Route. Scenic Route Guiding is here to help you with your goals, big or small, like Marcy or Slide or Low in the Sewers. Check out the Scenic Route Guiding and Gear Rentals on Instagram and Facebook for much more information. Also, if you mention the podcast, you can get 10% off. Use the code MOUNTAINLION. Also, check out Another Summit, a nonprofit program that leads outdoor adventure activities for veterans and first responders for free. Activities like walking or to hiking or even backpacking and paddling trip. Check out anothersummit.org for more information on dates and future events. I'm working in the process with Another Summit to do something for our future events for veterans and first responders. So let me know if you guys want to hook up anything and I will get you hooked up. So let's get on to the guests of the night.
Let's go.
All right, so Danny Davis is here to talk with me about geomorphology and the Catskills. So we're going to get into some controversial topics in here once again.
Yes.
It's all about the whole thing, as I've always heard about, is what is the term? Is it a dissected plateau or a mountain range? We'll get into that
later. Oh, great.
We'll get into that later. So welcome to the show, Danny. Thank you for joining me. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
You know, I followed you a while on Instagram, and your time is at Team Danger Girl, and it was always a big question mark. So I'm glad we hooked up. I'm glad we chatted about this. And once again, I had no clue you were involved in geomorphology and stuff like that. So this brings a whole new book to my chapter, because I've been waiting for someone. I've always, you know, I've talked to people about geology and stuff, but I always wondered about geomorphology and what it is, how it's shaped the Catskills, and I can't wait to hear about it tonight. So thank you for joining me. So why don't you give a background about yourself real quick? Not real quick. You can take as long as you want, buddy.
Well, first though, I'm just going to say that, you know, you've had some really good geologists on your show in the past. And that was one of the things that, you know, got me to start listening, is that, you know, I know Bob Titus and Carl, and I know a lot of the people that Carl works with at the Geological Survey, and it was just nice. It was really good to be able to have them on there, and it's a good resource, really, to be able to get some science out so that, you know, people have it. So my background is I've been living in New York since 1987, moved here from Fairbanks, Alaska with my partner at the time and four kids, a dog and two cats. We'd been living outside of Fairbanks in a dry cabin. That was a cabin without running water, but we did have electricity. I was a geology student there, studied geology at University of Alaska Fairbanks, and moved here and studied geology again at SUNY New Paltz. And I've been working as a geologist, specializing in water since 1990. Studying groundwater for about 7 to 8 years. I was a computer modeler of groundwater flow, and ended up starting to work for the New York City DEP in late 1996, early 97, and have been working for New York City DEP ever since. And I am the stream studies coordinator for the stream management program for New York City DEP, where we work with like a lot of local partners to try to foster good stream stewardship in the Catskills, since it supplies the unfiltered drinking water to New York City. And my particular focus of work is on stream geomorphology, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But so that's my sort of the arc of my profession in terms of the science. But I just love hiking. So I've been hiking since I was a kid. I was born in Alaska, but I grew up in the southern U.S. And then for quite a while in the Smoky Mountains area. So that was my introduction to mountains. And then I went to Alaska when I was 18, went back there, and spent a lot of time in the mountains there. And then the Catskills and the Gunks really became my like mountain home for the last almost 30 years, really, for quite some time. And I would say since 2011 is when I kind of really started hiking a lot in the Catskills and caught that bug. I did my first round of the Catskills with Heather Rowland when we were wearing formal ball gowns. So we did this Gowns for Greenbacks thing, which was to raise money for the 3500 Club to sponsor a lean-to repairs. And so Heather and I were joined by lots of people on that, but we were the only two to sort of do it all in ball gowns and sometimes, you know, other attire. And then went to visit them all again in the winter. And then I fell in love with the Burroughs Range, did them all just over and over again. Then that became the grid. And then that that cured me of any peak bagging after that. And so now I just like to just go and visit the same few mountains over and over again, but just approaching them differently each time.
Correct. And I see your definite way of approaching the mountains differently each time, because it makes a whole different experience. It makes you feel the Catskills in a whole different way.
Yeah, that's great. Didn't know the terrain, really.
Yeah, awesome. So you've been doing this stuff for the DEP for almost, 17 years now?
No, I started in 97. Okay. Coming on 27, 25 years.
Oh, shit. Like,
I don't even want to do the math right now.
God. Now that's the, sorry. I'm getting old.
No. So, but I started really studying streams in 2000, in the year 2000, and have really, my career for the last 23 years has been studying Catskill streams, and mostly in the Esopus watershed. So
So you're very, very important, because, of course, all this water that flows from the Catskills areas goes down into New York City for their reservoir, the water systems, correct?
Well, I think in terms of the importance part, the only importance I have is that I try to be a good parent and grandparent. But in terms of my work, you know, whatever, not so much. But the but yes, this water that I study, that's in the streams that I study, is what gets into the reservoirs and then is transferred down to the city where it's not filtered and into the distribution system. And so what I really investigate is, you know, how do the streams influence the water quality that ends up in the reservoir?
Yeah. And if you don't know, if anybody doesn't know about the reservoir system, that is a huge part of Catskill Mountain history, as in we've adapted so many different ways with the Schoharie Reservoir, with the Pecaptan Reservoir, the Ashokan Reservoir, to bring down amazing, beautiful, unfiltered water down to New York City to 7 million, 8 million people now, which is huge. I find the history of that blows my mind every time I read something different. You know, I've talked with you about the aqueduct that just absolutely blows my mind, that it basically hasn't been altered ever since when? Like 1950s? 1940s? 1950s?
I don't know. I think, you know, I really don't really... I would say the best thing is to read Diane Galusha's books. If you really want to know a lot about this, is definitely check in with Diane. It's funny. I work for the city and I'm very involved in the water supply, and it's 9 million people that actually
drink. Oh, 9 million now. Sorry.
And it's not just the New York City, it's several communities along the way. But correct. Because I'm really here as talking to you as a hiker and as a scientist, I'm probably not going to really get into the whole DEP water system, because I just really didn't think through that for our visit at the bar tonight. But yeah. I definitely think Diane Galusha's books, and there's some really good videos out there about the history of the, you know, the making of the dams and the infrastructure and the just the marvels of taking water from over 100 miles away and having gravity drive much of that water all the way down so that it can actually even have enough pressure to like rise up into some of the buildings. It's pretty remarkable. Yeah. My part is just focusing on how does stream erosion and flooding, which impacts and can lead to stream erosion, how does that impact the sediment that gets delivered to the reservoirs. And we typically see that as muddy water, and that's turbidity, which is just really cloudy water, water you can't see through, and how that affects the ability to be able to use that water if it's not filtered. Yeah. So my work is really looking at sort of, I get to spend the time in the streams. So basically I spend my work days when I'm not in my office, I am usually in a stream somewhere.
Sounds like a fantastic job to me.
It is a pretty fantastic job. Yeah.
So let's talk about the geomorphology real quickly about the Catskills. What do you have to add besides your little background before when we talked about the Catskill geomorphology?
Well, it's such a broad topic. No, so it is. Geomorphology is the study of, really simply, it's the study of landscapes, the forms, you know, say mountains, valleys, and the processes that make those. So it would be, you know, whatever led to that uplift, and then the weathering that sort of eroded out the mountains and created the valleys. I specifically study streams, and the fancy word for that is fluvial geomorphology, but that just basically means I study rivers and streams and how they function and trend towards sort of stable forms over long periods of time, and how that all of that influences the quality of the water. And the wonderful thing about studying streams in the Catskills is that you actually get to engage with the history of streams in the Catskills that isn't just like what we're experiencing now, say, or even like the last 100 years or 1,000 years, but probably 10 to 15,000 years after, just in that period after the ice that covered the Catskills left and streams came back and started moving a lot of the sediment around. But even before the ice was here, streams were the main creators of the mountain landscape. You know, that's that whole idea, fluvial dissected plateau versus mountains, that, you know, fluvial dissection just is a fancy way of saying streams cutting or incising into the landscape. That's been going on for tens of millions of years. So when you're looking up at the mountains and you're down in the, you know, the modern streams, say you're like in the Westkill just below the falls, and you look up at the mountains, you're looking at this landscape that streams have been working on for, you know, tens of millions of years. It's amazing. And the really cool thing is, if you're, especially say you're on the Westkill and you're at the falls, you're at the Diamond Notch or Buttermilk Falls, whichever name you want for it.
Yeah.
And you look at that sandstone, and that sandstone that you see, that, you know, the water is flowing through those beautiful little flumes and then over that waterfall, and then down into that nice pool. Well, the top rock is all that sandstone. That's basically fossilized riverbeds from the Devonian. So say 385 million years ago,
Wow. The
rivers that were on this part of the planet were laying down the sand. And then below those, where the waterfall is, if you go down under there and you get onto the ledges, you see that it's actually not sandstone anymore. It's like shale and siltstone and maybe something we call mudstone, and it's easily breaks. And then that waterfall is there because you get this mudstone that can easily break. And so you get this like sort of a nick point in the stream, and that's how waterfalls are made. And the cool thing about that is that's basically how the mountains have been made. That little nick point where that falls is slowly through tens of thousands of years, working its way back and lowering the mountain bottom, the valley bottom, which steepens the mountain sides. And then you just sort of extrapolate that out over tens of millions of years, and you can sort of explain how the mountain landscape was formed between, you know, glaciers and streams kind of cutting it back and forth. So it's
wow. Basically saying that some of these mountains were once small waterfalls, and then they expanded into massive waterfalls, right?
I think we've got massive waterfalls. I mean, you know, Black Chasm is amazing.
Oh yeah,
there's all sorts of amazing waterfalls in the Cloves, and we have small waterfalls. I think what I'm just saying is that if you take all the small ones and the big ones, and you distribute them across the Catskills, you just have that process that creates those waterfalls go on for tens of millions of years. that's how you carve out these mountains, because these mountains aren't really being pushed up anymore. The process that lifted up the terrain, it's hypothesized. And I've talked to Dr. Chuck Verstraeten is an amazing geologist. He is the world's expert on Catskill Devonian geology. And he just gave a talk, a wonderful outside talk at the Mountaintop Arboretum. He works for the New York State Museum. So he's both a geologist, a rock doctor, but he's also a great educator. So I recommend reaching out to him in the future. So when I asked him about, are the Catskills Mountains or just a fluvial dissected plateau, we were talking about how did the land get lifted up? And what happened basically is, as all the sediment that was on top of the Catskill bedrock got eroded away, the crust kind of just kept lifting up. You took all that weight off and it slowly lifted the Earth's crust up. And then the slow uplift of that was being competed by that process of the streams, the weathering, the climate, delivering water and ice and carving out these mountains. So you have a really unique mountain landscape in the Catskills. They look like mountains, they smell like mountains, they feel like mountains, they hike like mountains. They have the ecosystem of mountains. Their formation is kind of unique in that it is a dissected plateau, but the end result are these just incredible mountains created by the slow, long process of streams and glacial ice.
Wow. Unbelievable. So once again, it goes all around and comes around, stuff like that. Talking about like the glaciers retreating, and then of course the waters coming in, so that creates our mountains right now. So why, a big question, of course, with around the area going up towards more north or the east, why are there less slides in the Catskills than in the other areas? I love slides. I look at those and I see those and it's just so cool. And we only have a few here in the Catskills.
Yeah. It's a question that I'm intrigued by that question. I think, there's some possible answers. There's probably many reasons why, that we have, the particular kinds of slides that we have and the amount that we have, as opposed to say, the Adirondacks or the Whites, where you're in very different geology, right? So there, it's not this repeated layers of sandstone and mudstone and sandstone and mudstone, and then some conglomerates as you keep getting higher up. So, but in the Catskills, you may notice when you're up on the fire towers or any good mountain vista, that when you look at them, especially this time of year is like the best time of year, I think, to see the profiles of the mountains. They're like stair steps. So there's a level and then there's a ramp and there, there's like a tread and then a riser and then a tread and then a riser. And so you get this sort of stair step profile. And that's because of that sandstone, mudstone. And so it's hard for big slides to form in the bedrock because it's like steps, trying to get a slide to form in steps. Nice. Whereas if you're out in the Adirondacks or the Whites, so the Whites, you're dealing with more granitic rocks, and the Adirondacks, you're dealing with these amazing anorthosites and some metamorphic rocks, but it's a much more uniform kind of rock in that it doesn't have that stair step profile. So it's a lot easier for slides that remove all the vegetation that's lying over the bedrock to sort of go down, because one, you have steeper slopes there, but you also don't have all of those stair steps checking in. So like a good example of seeing that in the Catskills happened after Tropical Storm Irene. If you go up Deep Notch 42, say you're heading up from Bushnellsville and you're going to head over and down into Lexington, with Tropical Storm Irene in August of 2011, there was a big landslide right at the notch, where there's a little pool, a little pond of water on the right side of the road as you're heading north. And this landslide just came from pretty far up the slope. Maybe it's Sleeping Lion, I don't know. And it came down and across and totally blocked the road, filled that channel. But when you look up at it, it isn't like, say, looking at the Trap Dyke slide or a lot of the slides you see in the Adirondacks. It's this really rough and stair-steppy kind of slide. And then a lot of the sediment that was slid got caught. And then it very quickly, over, say, 5 to the last, say, 10 years, has revegetated.
Yeah.
Because our slopes are able to kind of retain soil because of that stair step profile. It sort of helps them, the forest, recover quicker.
Yeah.
So a lot of the times slides here don't last quite as long.
Yeah. And so once again, the slides kind of don't form as much because there's more soil here in the Catskills than there is
no.
up in
Oh, wow. I mean, well, maybe. There's not a lot of soil. There's a lot of talus in the Catskills, that's for sure.
And that makes the stair steps, right?
Stair steps is definitely from the sandstone and shale alternating layers. But the talus is from the quarrying of those sandstone cliffs. And so often the talus is actually covering some of that shale that is, you know, okay. those big talus slopes. Boy, we were in some big talus slopes this on Saturday when we were heading up Wittenberg. It's pretty wild. Yeah.
Those little chippy away things that that you battle when you're going up some certain sort of slopes in the Catskills, you can definitely tell.
So that's slides basically in the Catskills, but that's one kind. That's bedrock. The kind that I like. So I'm not a peak bagger anymore, but I'm definitely a slide bagger. So I look around for slides because they're like, you get to look inside the earth, you know, you get to see what's beneath the vegetation. And so there's the slides that form at the base of us where a stream is cutting into a hill slope. And so you get a flood and the high water cuts into the base of that slope and it oversteepens it. And then the whole hill slope slides down into the stream. And usually that's like a glacial deposit. So maybe it's glacial till. It could be glacial lake sediment because there were big glacial lakes here as the ice was advancing and retreating. But then what you get are these great exposures of that ice age sediment. And there's quite a few of those in the Catskills. You just have to look for them when the leaves are off the trees.
You got to know where you want to look. You got to know what you're looking for.
Yeah. Sorry. I could talk forever about that. So probably best
to get
the topic of slides.
No, it's good. We should do a whole nother podcast on slides in the Catskills, because I got to admit, those fascinate me. Can we talk about turbulence in the Catskills?
Yeah. So I would much rather talk about hiking than turbidity, but it's important. It's been, you know, a big part of my career for the last few years. So why does turbidity matter? And again, I'm going to keep this pretty light because this isn't an official DEP thing that I'm doing here, but turbidity matters because for many reasons. Let's just think about a drinking water supply. Turbidity is cloudy water, and something has to be suspended to cloud that water. It could be algae. It could be sediment. In our case, it's very, very fine sediment. It's silt. It's clay. And often that silt and clay is coming from where streams are eroding into that glacial legacy sediment, some of the sediment that was left behind by the ice age, as well as just moving around the stream sediment that's been around for thousands of years. That ends up in the reservoir. It can actually have pathogens, can adhere to silt and clay. So, you know, microscopic microbes can sort of hitch a ride with the silt and clay and then get in that water supply. So that's one way that turbidity has a sort of a negative impact on an unfiltered drinking water supply. So you have to manage it with that in mind. But it also matters, you know, ecologically. Turbidity is natural. I mean, you go to any glacial river and you're going to see a very turbid stream. It's, you know, from the glacial flower. But it can be in systems that are not as adapted to it, you know, tough for trout, for feeding, for foraging. It can have some effects just on biota in general if it's really sustained and chronic, say it's really like a significant amount over a long period of time. Recreationally, I mean, I don't know if you hike streams. I hike streams a lot. If you can't see where the boulders are, your shins will tell you where they are. I have shins that will document the history of my engagement with stream boulders.
Of course.
And so from that, you know, just say as you're an angler or whatever, So I think, you know, there's a lot of reasons why we sort of care about turbidity. But what I'm sort of charged with is understanding how is it produced in the streams, and then how can you effectively take some management action to reduce it. So I'm doing a 10-year research project with the United States Geological Survey, along with some support from different universities, to really study this in the Esopus watershed. We have over 30 monitoring stations in the Esopus Creek watershed, and 20 of those are in the Stony Clove Creek watershed. And so Stony Clove Creek is the creek that flows along Route 214. And so it starts up at the Notch, where the little Notch, Stony Clove Notch Lake is. And then you head down valley through Edgewood and Lanesville, make your way down into Chichester and then into Phoenicia, and it goes into Esopus. And it's the biggest tributary stream to the Esopus Creek. And so that's where we're doing our deep dive research to understand, you know, like for the last, I'm just going to say 10 to 15,000 years, because it's not exact, since the ice left. The glacial ice melted. It was a very messy retreat. It left behind big glacial lakes and small glacial lakes filled with, you know, decaying ice and leaving behind lots of silt and clay. But as the ice retreated, those lakes melted, you know, those lakes were released as the ice pulled back. So the dams that were holding back the water moved. And so you had a rapid draining of these glacial lakes. Streams came back. And so say sometime between 10 to 15,000 years ago, streams have been reworking all this sediment. So we're really just trying to understand like what's happening now in the context of that larger time frame. So we have this 10-year study where we're monitoring stream flow every 15 minutes and turbidity every 15 minutes for 10 years. So 10 years of 15 minutes is a lot of data. And I am doing a lot of mapping of the glacial legacy sediment and erosion in the watershed. And we're trying to tell that story. You know, what is the story of turbidity in the Catskills? And then New York City, along with our county partners and stream management program, build these big stream restoration projects that try to remove the stream from that turbidity source. Say it's a erosion into a glacial lake sediment. And we measure how effective that is. So, you know, how effective can we be at making some difference? So that's what that work is that I do.
Wow. Unbelievable stuff. Wow. That is just an amazing amount of research that you have to do. Piling together all this information just on one stream of Stony Clove Creek, one simple stream, when all these tributaries that form into the Esopus that we all know, like we all hike up, you know, when we go up, let's say you go up Balsam and there's McKinley Hollow has that stream that flows right into the Esopus.
Oh man. Yeah. And it's got some serious sediment issues. Yeah,
exactly. And like a lot of these people don't realize that, you know, some of these small little streams that flow into the Esopus that flow into other creeks or other streams have a big spot of turbulence and then can cause damage to the water and to your natural area. You know, one little flow.
Yeah, I might just say that maybe even more significant than turbidity, because turbidity is sort of this what's suspended and really is going to ultimately have an impact much further downstream. But it's the coarse material. It's all the sand, the gravel, the boulders, the cobble. You know, when you talked about McKinley Hollow, that's in Big Indian Hollow, right? So that's in Olivia area. And you have, you know, McKinley Hollow, Elk Bushkill, Hatchery Hollow, Lost Clove, Peck Hollow, Hanging Bird Nest. You have all of these streams coming off those mountains. And they all have alluvial fans at the bottom because they're just putting so much sediment into Esopus that when you fly over Esopus, and I've had the privilege of getting a lot of great helicopter rides across the over Esopus, you can see how braided the river is because it's having to process all of that sediment coming from those side valleys.
Yeah. It's tough to think about because a lot of people, you know, when they hike up these small streams, these areas, you know, that have these small, like these hiking areas, they don't think about that. They don't think about how much of an impact a small stream could have on a large stream. you know, that could just wipe out this whole small stream, could wipe out a whole area and then block the larger stream because of all the sediment that it pushed down during one massive rainstorm.
Yeah. Fortunately, in the Catskills, I mean, this is one thing that I will say is probably, I want to say, nationally unique, but I might be exaggerating, but there is such an investment in outreach and education and outreach on this. I'm just going to put a plug for the Ashokan Watershed Stream Management Program.
Oh, wow.
The website is ashokanstreams.org. And there's another website called catskillstreams.org. And those websites can take you to a lot of information. But what I like about the Ashokan Watershed Stream Management Program website is they have links to all of these really accessible guides on, you know, how to understand streams, how to live by streams, information. They actually have an Ashokan adventure guide, which is sort of, I think it has 11 stops along the way. And one of them is actually the Halkop Mountain, the Halkop Mountain parking area to look at the waterfall there, different places. And it takes you to these different locations in the watershed, and it teaches you something about the role and importance of, say, streams in the landscape. So the Catskills are really cool in that there's a big effort to really educate the people who visit or make their homes in the Catskills.
Yeah. And a big thing, of course, we go with the amount of history. When we used to have all these pines and balsams that were growing thick in the Catskills that held our streams together. Now, of course, of the logging and the of tanning and stuff ripped apart those areas. Now our streams are more vulnerable to erosion and decay because of that amazing amount of tannery that happened, what, 100 years ago, a little over 100 years ago?
More than. But, you know, the interesting thing is, though, I mean, I know you've spent time with Mike Kudish. Many of us have that are fortunate to have that time with Mike. And one of the things that I've learned from Mike is just how resilient the forests are here in recovery. So even though, you know, I see photos from, say, like the turn of the 20th century, and you just see these big denuded mountainsides. I mean, then you look at those mountainsides now, and they're mostly all forested. And also because it depends on where you are in the Catskills, but I'm thinking like, say, you know, the Phoenicia area. A lot of the landscape recovered, but what's happening now that's really affecting it is all the ashes are dying. Hemlocks have the woolly adelgid, the ashes, you know, an emerald ash borer, beech, which aren't necessarily so much a streamside tree, but, you know, the beech have the beech blight. So, you know, I spend a lot of time in Catskill Forest, and there's a lot of trees that are dying, and a lot of those are getting in the streams, which are ending up, you know, and trees in streams is a good thing, but when you get a lot of them, it can really create a lot of erosion.
Yeah.
So and we're really seeing the landscape adjust to, you know, not only climate changing hydrology and maybe changing the magnitude and frequency of our floods, but also the impacts of invasive species getting in and, you know, very quickly wiping out a whole bunch of trees that, you know, the landscape isn't used to having to process that many dead trees at one time.
Yeah. And would the people don't understand that the trees, basically their roots hold together the soil and stuff like that for our mountains and stuff like that. So if you don't have that kind of like that togetherness of the trees, then the soil is just going to wipe down into the mountains and your mountains are going to go clear. And if we have the emerald ash borer and the woolly algid, they're just going to wipe out these mountainsides and make these streams massive and huge and have all this flooding and stuff like that. So,
it depends because some things are growing, you know, so as those trees are dying, other trees are coming in. So there will be a change. I think there'll be a change in the forest community. The challenge will be, you know, if say big erosion does happen in the landscape, it does take some time for it to
recover. Yeah.
But I think watching to see what happens. But I'm going to use a word that you just used, if you don't mind. I sometimes give talks and I think you said the togetherness of the trees, or the trees' togetherness, or something. I'm going to remember that because one of the things that really helps hold wild mountain rivers together, even though they face incredible floods and just high energies, is that when you walk those streams and you see that the boundaries of the stream are just defined by tree roots and just really holding the bank together. I'm gonna talk about the togetherness of trees, and I'll cite you. Thanks, Stosh.
Please, thank you. That's that. the trees make me. You know, when you see those fallen trees, they remind me of veins. They remind me of the flow of water, the flow of life, basically. And that the trees, you always see them kind of like right on the edge of each other. Yeah. And it blows my mind to think of that. And, you know, I point that out to people who have no clue about that. And I'm just like, look at that. I'm like, that tree that's fallen over sideways was touching that tree right next to it, was touching that tree 15 feet away. And they're just like, why? I'm like, how? I'm like, the roots. I'm like, they were like, that's like their boundary. And it's just absolutely phenomenal to see. And just to see that root system of 20 feet. It's just absolutely insane. It's just phenomenal.
It is.
So let's get out of the talk about, you know, the slides and destroying of the mountains and stuff like that. Let's get into the amazing blue lining that you did with Team Danger Girl. I've been always interested in blue lining, but, you know, I haven't taken on that quest because I'm too afraid that I'm going to fall by myself, fall down a stream 25 feet and kill myself by getting in between a rock and the water. So talk to me about blue lining.
That is possible, I guess. I'm happy to talk about that. But I do just want to make one correction, if that's okay, or one distinction. And that is that landslides don't destroy the mountains. Landslides are one of the processes that makes the mountains. So true. Landslides are just where climate has made a new sort of scrape into the side of the mountain and just locally steepened it up a little bit. So
I'm glad that you say that, because a lot of people, you know, like, will disagree and be like, it's destroying everything, blah, blah, blah. It's one of our natural processes, you know.
It helps make the mountains. So streamlining, the blue lining, that was something I did with Catskill Mountain Club, and it was like a Team Danger Girl thing. And a shout out to my Team Danger Girl friends who, like I said, I was just on an awesome hike with Dorcinda, who's Danger Girl, and Stefan, who's GPS, and Luke, who's Mountain Joy. And we have done so many awesome adventures together, and wanted to try to do some hikes with the public, with the Catskill Mountain Club. So we're thinking about the thing that I like to do, and a lot of us like to do, is hike streams up mountains. So we set up a series for a year. I can't remember which year it was now. I'm embarrassed to say. and we started with Bear Hole Brook up to Van Wyck.
So we start,
and the idea of the blue lining was to be adventure, but also educational. So we had different naturalists along. Like, I was there as a geologist. We had someone who was really good at bird ID, two or three different botanists. So we sort of made it like a little bit of an expedition to sort of record some of the things that we saw. And then also get up to Van Wyck, which was great. And so that was a lot of fun. Marv Friedman, you know, Marv was on that hike. Sue Hall. There's a few other people.
Nice.
That ended up doing a lot of those hikes with us, with me. And so that we did that. And we did Biscuit Brook up to Furs Summit. And nice. We hiked Westkill up to Hunter's Summit. Woodland Creek up to the slide on slide, the old slide on slide.
Yeah.
And came up the summit that way. There are a couple of others that we did. And then I was using Facebook at the time, which I'm not really now, but I noticed maybe we're creating something where it's actually going to have an impact, because maybe blue lining will be like peak bagging or something, and people will really, more and more people will go. So it seemed like a good idea to not kind of continue it as a public thing. But I do always encourage people to walk streams, because it's really you really are walking, you know, along the course of the process that's really making these mountains. So you really
get a chance
to learn. And there's some awesome waterfalls, man, that you can explore. You can either climb the waterfalls if you're into that, or there's always been a go around. There hasn't been a stream. I haven't been able to find a way to get up to where it's just a idea of a stream. There's not even really a channel left. Another wonderful one is Warner Creek. You can take that up to a plateau, and you can actually follow a thread of the stream of Warner Creek. You can follow this thread, and if you stay on that same bearing, it'll take you right to the little teeny bump that's the summit of plateau. So it's pretty fun. Yeah. So that's that was, you know, sort of an organized thing, but I think just hiking streams is just a great way to get to know the Catskills and to get to know and love nettles, especially if you do it in June, July, August, September. Nettles love water. Streams have a water. Nettles love disturbed surfaces, and gravel bars are pretty frequently disturbed surfaces. So you have to become one with the nettles, but that's all right. Just, you know, dress appropriately or get used to it. I also use my running shoes, actually the best shoes that I found are La Sportiva Raptors, but not the waterproof kind, the kind that will drain. But they're, what's great about the La Sportiva Raptors is the sole is really sticky. So when I used to do a lot of mountain running, would like to try and go, or just extended hiking, like go do the Great Range and a bunch of other peaks. They're great sticky shoes on bedrock, but they're also actually sticky shoes when you're in the wet. So get good grippy shoes that drain really well, and be ready, like I said, for nettles, black flies, mosquitoes, waterfalls, but lots of surprises.
So Team Danger Girl, was that just something you guys formed as friends just to check out all this stuff? Were you guys like kind of acquainted on Facebook and stuff like that?
You know, it started on a particular hike up Friday Mountain in February of 2012. But my friends aren't here to tell that story. So I'll hang on to that one. Let them tell it sometime maybe. But I was out with my friends, Dorcinda Knaut, Stefan Lazowski, and then Emily Polinsky, was Emily Smith at the time, who was a young intern working with me at DEP. And we were heading up Ralph's Ramp, actually, and trying to find another way up the cliff. We wanted to sort of not take Ralph's Ramp, but find another way that was going to be more ridiculous. And that's how Dorcinda got the, you know, she got the name Danger Girl on that hike. And we all just sort of gave each other names and became a group, and then had other friends, and it just sort of became a community. It's really a team. It was just a community of hikers, you know, and we still get together. Like I said, you know, there's four of us that get together a lot. There's several more, but we usually try to find something fun to do that we haven't done before, if possible.
I got to admit, blue lining, you know, I haven't done much of it, but I have done decent amount of it, and that I'll say a decent amount, a couple times, you know, where I've gone up, like I want to check this out, you know. I've gone on the Flatiron Brook going up to Grand Mountain.
Oh yeah, yeah, yep, I've been up that.
Wow, what a phenomenal hike that is. Like you said,
absolutely
oh, can't go up there anymore, unfortunately.
I know I'm so glad I did the grid when I did, because I was able to visit Graham 13 times, and heading up those drainages is really great. Yeah. Have you ever been up Shandaken Brook, which is heads up towards Eagle? Just check that out sometime. It's really worth it.
That's the one that goes towards the left of the lean-to, correct?
Yes, I think, I think if you take the stream that's near the lean-to or by the lean-to or whatever, and you follow that all the way up and you get on one of its tribs, it takes you up this brook. That's just one big flumy waterfall after another. It's pretty amazing.
Maybe. No, I think I've been up to, Dry Brook. I've gone all the way up Dry Hook, not Shandaken, but I've been up through Dry Brook. But yeah, I got to admit, going up those streams and stuff like that is definitely another way to look at the geology and the formation of these mountains. It's just you'll get along a spot that's, you know, a couple hundred feet of this, and then all of a sudden it dramatically changed.
Yeah, I do love that.
It's just one of those things that you're like, holy crap, I didn't know this existed. But don't do blue lining. I suggest don't do it. Leave it alone. This is horrible crap. Nettles, slippery, and you're going to die.
Since I have no responsibility here, I just, I recommend that visit a Catskill stream. And even if you don't, you know, walk it, because it is risky. You have to, I do it for a living. So it's something that I feel pretty confident in. But it really is a great, if you're interested in the geology of an area, it's a great way to do it, because all the sediment you see in the stream, every piece of sand and gravel or cobble, especially nice big hand-sized chunk of cobble, is from the bedrock of the area the stream is draining. And so it can tell you right there in a gravel bar what, you know, the geology is upstream of there. So just getting out and exploring Catskill streams is another great way to get to experience the Catskill Mountains.
Correct. Awesome. Thank you so much about that. I love it. So, Danny, I ask a lot of people that, have you ever been any close calls in the mountains? It doesn't matter, in the Catskills or anywhere else.
Yeah. And I have. And I've had some close calls in the Catskills. I had some close calls in the Adirondacks. One where I almost went over one of the cliffs on Basin in the wintertime and a tree stopped me. But and those were all, like, I was trying to do the Adirondack 46 solo winter. And I think that I got to within 7 and realized how stupid that was and stopped, especially when I had that experience, which was basically just my Cthulhu's, my spikes balling up with snow, and I had no traction. And so I hit a bit of ice and just went sailing. So those are things, in my 50s. But when I was in my 20s, I lived in Alaska and did a lot in the Alaska Range. I was a student in geology at University of Alaska at Fairbanks. And so one time, I think it was in March of 1983, I joined a small group of professors and some graduate students in the geology department on a trip up the Black Rapids Glacier that drains a bunch of really big peaks. These are like 14 to, 15, 16,000 foot type peaks that had a large, big glacial basin called the Trinity Basin, big, beautiful, flat basin surrounded by these beautiful peaks that had big slopes of snow. And we flew in, there were 10 of us, and flew in lots of gear. And we had 6 days to ski mountaineer as many of those peaks as we could. And so we spent the first day building snow caves that we all connected with tunnels. So we were sort of like a little community of prairie dogs. We each had our own little snow cave, but we had a community cave that you could, we had carved out snow tables and had brought along a risk game and created a bar, and it was very cushy. then we skied and climbed for about 4 or 5 days. And then on the 6th day, when it was time to leave, the deal was that we were all going to ski out. We had to ski down a glacier called the Black Rapids Glacier, which is a glacier known for it being a surging glacier. So a relatively fast moving glacier, and it's going over a steep slope. So it has lots of crevasses, and it's called Black Rapids because when you look at it from the air, it looks like you're looking at black rapids of a river going down, and every crevasse you see is sort of this dark blue that makes it look like you're going through rapids. So you had to ski past that, cross this frozen river called the Delta River to get to a road, and it's about 36 miles. The professors were smart and probably, not stoned or whatever, and they said, you know, hey, we're seeing the weather change. We're going to leave a day early. And so they all set out along with, I think, a couple of, so it was four. Yeah, four of them set out. And all of our gear, most of our gear was being flown back out. So all we had to do was just take, you know, enough for one night's camp to get back down out of there. But I stayed back with some students and some friends, and I was definitely the youngest one. I was the kid on this whole thing. Like I said, I just turned 21. And I had all borrowed gear. I had none of this was my gear. And we decided to stay longer, and we woke up the next day and you couldn't see a thing. We got out of our snow caves, and it was a raging blizzard. And this was March in the Alaska Range. So it was probably, I'm going to say, you know, we were, I think in terms of Celsius, but I'm going to try to remember Fahrenheit as best I can. I'm going to say it was probably in the negative, it was below zero Fahrenheit, with blowing snow and intense whiteout conditions. And it was like that all day. And we're like, oh man, we're gonna have to hang out here for a day. Thank goodness we have all this food, we have all this booze, we have risk, we'll just hang out, it'll be whatever. And the next day it was the same thing. And where our, like, our latrine place was, and the openings to the snow caves for the people that had left, you couldn't see them anymore. That much snow had fallen. And you couldn't, and you actually still had to, we had to rope together just to kind of walk around camp. The next day it was the same. So at this point, many feet of snow had fallen. We had to keep digging out. We were beginning to run out of food. Two people were starting to get hypothermia. So, but we were able to really kind of keep it at bay because we had lots of fuel. So we were able to melt water. We had lots of butter for some reason. So we were able to melt a lot of butter. So we had butter soup. We had a lot of coffee. You know, we're young, so we had a lot of party supplies. We had stuff that could keep us going for a couple more days. But then by the seventh day, so this was like day 12 or 13. So it was by day 12, we had run out of all food, and we did have some more fuel. By then, though, two or three people were not doing well. And it cleared. And the whole time this was happening, we could hear airplanes flying overhead. And this was a search and rescue trying to find the six missing backcountry skiers. That was like all the news. But we had a radio, but our radio didn't work. So we were not able to communicate out to people to let people know what happened. So the professors got back. They thought we were going the next day. They had no idea that this whiteout had happened as it had. And they thought we'd all perished, you know, in a crevasse or something. So it was a big search and rescue thing. Weather finally broke. People came out, and a guy came up on a snow machine. I remember there was this guy, search and rescue guy, came up on a snow machine. He had made it up above the Black Rapids Glacier. And he had cocoa and, you know, food and various things like that. And we were able to get a radio, and then three people had to be flown out. And then three of us skied out. And I skied out because I couldn't afford to fly out. And I had gear that was not really suitable for sleeping up on top of the glacier. So anyway, when we skied out, it took us 2 days, and overnight we had to camp above the glacier, and we were pretty weak because we had been without food for quite a while. I'd forgot to put my ski boots in my sleeping bag, and it was, you know, way below freezing. So the next morning when it was time to get up and get out of the bag and get into my boots, they were frozen solid. But I had to use them. So I skied out, but it didn't take long before my feet froze. And then my legs, but no, my knees froze, and I couldn't even feel, you know, my lower legs at all. So you can't ski very well when you can't feel your feet or your legs. So we all had to stop and zip our bags together. And all three of us that were skiing out got in a bag, in this big bag together, until the feeling came back to my feet. And then we continued to ski out, and then finally made it out. Took two days. Had to cross this river that was breaking up, so that was pretty crazy. And we finally get to this road, and then I'm able to get to a hospital because I did have pretty bad frostbite on my toes, but I didn't lose anything. So that was good. I just got, you know, a really good early lesson on really don't do stuff like that without really good gear. So I was, wow. I did a lot of stuff after that, but it was a good early lesson. And I was fortunate, you know, that I was with people that knew what they were doing, because I certainly didn't know what I was doing.
So being this sounds like a goddamn book that I've read, you know, about expeditions in Alaska and stuff.
It might be me glorifying it a little bit. I don't know, but no. It was a pretty cool adventure, but it was close. It was, you know, it was, if it had gone on longer, it would have been a lot harder for it to end as well as it did. And I'm still good friends with two or three of those people. They are all they're all still in Alaska.
But seriously, dude, this sounds like stuff. I'm trying to think of the ice axing area that the people climb up in Alaska. That's absolutely insane. That many people have died on, that I've read books about. That this sounds like where they've like, oh, you know, I could do it in this amount of days, but then all of a sudden a blizzard happens for 3 days, and they're cutting short on supplies. The plane was supposed to fly out on day four, but they missed that because of the storm and stuff. You're talking about like planes, like Cessnas and Pipers and stuff like that, correct?
Or we were in it took multiple trips. So small planes. Yeah. You know, but I mean, that's not that uncommon up there. You know, a good guy to talk to, do you know Dean Giuliano?
I do not.
Dean Giuliano, man, he will be a good person for you to speak with. He, has just recently attempted Denali twice. Both times there were some pretty severe weather issues. I think he's pretty high up on the board at the Adirondack 46. He's from, West Shokan, you know, the Moon Hall, that particular area. Peak Moose Adventures, I think, was the thing he and his dad did together, a guiding service. He is the person. If I have a question about the mountains in the Catskills, I ask Dean.
So nice.
He's a good person to ask about that. He's done the 100 highest and, all of the Northeast peaks, the Colorado 14, bunch of
volcanoes. About that. Let's talk about that experience. Crazy. Like, I don't know. Like that just like, that sounds like some sort of like book. Like it's insane, man. That's how could you, wow. Like, what were you thinking?
No, it really wasn't when you're in it. It really wasn't. It was just sort of more like, oh man, this was really stupid. And this cost me money because I had to pay for part of the search and rescue. We each had to come up with $2,000, and I was a pretty poor student at the time. You know, I didn't have the money. Right. Had to come up with it somehow. Had to deal with pretty damaged feet for quite a while. So I think, but I think it's not that uncommon of an occurrence, really.
Especially up there, yeah, where whiteout condition can happen in the blink of an eye, and you know, like you said, like forging down there is absolutely insane. You don't have to cross a, you know, a 10-foot river. You have to cross a 30-foot river that's flowing.
Yeah, in this case, we were doing it on frozen, so we were trying to stay. It wasn't a wadeable river. It's a really big. It was pretty. So we were having to find places where it hadn't thawed so that we could, you know, get across before it, you know, would crack or whatever.
You should write a book about this.
No.
It's incredible.
There's more important things to write about. Anyway.
Awesome. Wow. Unbelievable experience that you've had. Thank God that people don't have to deal with that stuff in the Catskills, because what an insane stuff you had to deal with. The thoughts just going through your heads of, you know, like, could this last another two? Could we last, let's just say that, for another two more days?
Like I said, we kept ourselves pretty inebriated for part of the time, and we built like a big, stomped out a big platform in the snow every day that we could go up and just run around in circles. We danced. I brought a flute, so we played music. we moved around. That was the important thing, is if you do get trapped in a situation where you're in the winter and you're in snow and you can't really get to a place where you can get away from that constant presence of the cold, moving around is really important.
Of course.
So we definitely made each other move around. We made each other talk and, you know, tell stories and be stupid. But yeah.
Crazy. Awesome. Well, thank you for that, that awesome experience that you had there in Alaska. Once again, it tells you to gear up basically and to prepare for the worst, even though, you know, you might not deal with it, you know, who knows, who the hell knows, especially in the winter time, that you definitely need to, bring all that you can to survive.
Yeah.
So,
and choose your friends that know a lot more than you do.
Exactly.
People who can show you things.
Being the young one of the group, did they tell you to do a lot? Were they like, hey, youngin', go and do this?
No, I was being the young one in the group. I was the one that broke the snow shovel. I was the one that, you know, I made every rookie mistake you could possibly make on that trip.
Man. So,
yeah, no.
Well, glad you were alive and here today to tell that story. That's an awesome story.
Me too. Life got really good after that. So, yeah.
Good. Good. Right. So last question, post-hike brews and bites. What do you suggest to go out and to eat after a good hike in the Catskill, sir?
Yeah, I always, you know, in the interviews that you've done that I've listened to, I like this question because I like to hear what people have to say. And I would say, because of where I hike, I kind of limit the area now. I mostly just really focus on exploring the Burroughs Range. I must always end up at Brio's just because I have been doing it for years. They know me. I know them.
Nice.
There's even a particular pizza that, you know, they know exactly how I or we, it's really like a Team Danger Girl kind of a thing. We like it. And so that's really it, because I can get a Devil's Path IPA. I can get a really good pizza and I can relax. And usually there's a hiking community group of different groups from the hiking community kind of come through there. So you can see people that were also out and about. Although I have to say, going to Snyder's Tavern the other day, that especially after this, you know, really tough hike and getting out in the dark, we got back to our cars at 8. So we were in the dark for, you know, like 2 to 3 hours. And going to that place, it was like being in another time, in another world. So for that experience, I think for something that feels like it hasn't been, you know, impacted by, you know, some of the cultural changes that have gone on in the area, it feels pretty authentic.
Right. If you want a full authentic Catskill experience that hasn't been altered since 1900s, go to Snyder's Tavern.
They didn't serve food when we were there. So I don't know if it was because we got there so late, but it didn't really matter what beer. I think I got a Corona or something. It was just being in that space, which is kind of cool.
Right. Gotta agree with that one. Both of those. Brios, once again, Brios has a gift certificate to the 100th episode celebration. So put your money in for that. So Danny, thank you once again for joining me tonight. I really appreciate you taking out your time talking about geomorphology and stuff like that. I really want to have you in on another like 4 or 5 episodes. So if you don't mind, let's go deeper into this.
We'll do this one. We'll see. You know, I do think that there's a lot of great people out there. It's a wonderful community, and I think it's a cool thing you're doing. I mean, to be able to be committed to getting to 100 episodes, and I know it's got to not be easy to do this, just wrangling people, like even trying to communicate with me and other people, it's a lot of work. So it's pretty cool. So, I think you're going to have a lot more. There's lots of people for you to keep this going for a while.
Definitely. I can't wait. So once again, thank you to the monthly supporters and the monthly sponsors. Really appreciate it. You guys are doing amazing things for me and for the Catskill community. Thank you to everyone who has donated. Really appreciate it. Your money goes towards the show and not towards me. I will 100% guarantee you that. Also, thank you to everyone who is listening. I really appreciate you guys following me through 99 episodes of the show. 100's coming up. Can't wait. Great to have 99 with Danny here, because I was just immense with his information that he had for me. It was just absolutely phenomenal. I wish, once again, I said four more episodes probably wouldn't cover the amount of stuff that I have to ask him. And he probably would get bored after, you know, two episodes. So thank you, Danny, for joining me tonight.
Oh, you're welcome. All right. Thank you.
All right. Have a good night, Danny.
Hey, guys, I just want to thank you for listening to the show. If you enjoyed the show, subscribe and throw down a smooth review on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or any podcast platform that you use. You can also check daily updates of the podcast, hikes, hiking memes, and local news on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and the official website of the show. Remember this, you just keep on living, man. L-I-V-I-N.
Wicked, 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 wicked.